This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Andy Herber, a PA in hospital medicine at Mayo Clinic's Rochester, Minnesota campus. The complete blood count, or CBC, is one of the most commonly ordered laboratory tests. Primary care providers are frequently tasked to evaluate all aspects of the CBC. A keen understanding of this laboratory test is essential to providing quality care. This is the first episode in our CBC edition of Lab Medicine. This episode will concentrate on evaluating abnormalities in hemoglobin. Today, we're joined by Dr. Ronald Goh, a Mayo Clinic hematologist and professor of medicine in the Mayo College of Medicine and a highly decorated educator. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Goh.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
So our first question, as you know, Dr. Goh, we're going to be talking about hemoglobin today. So primary care providers are ordering a CBC. Lo and behold, that hemoglobin comes back elevated. What are some things that you would want outpatient providers to know?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I would say for outpatient setting, the clinical context is important. If the hemoglobin is above the normal and is unsuspected or not expected, then repeating the CBC, it's always a good thing just to make sure that the hemoglobin is truly above the normal. That's what I would do. Certainly in a situation when the hemoglobin is clearly way above the normal, say it's like 18 or 20, I think that's probably real, but it still deserves a repeat CBC. So that's the first thing I would do. And, you know, if it's consistently above the normal, certainly that may be time to do further evaluation. However, the question here always is an elevated hemoglobin a blood disease or not a blood disease? That's really the basic question here. And this is probably true for any CBC abnormal values. Is this a heme problem or is it a non-heme problem? In which case, if it's a non-heme problem, it's like secondary causes. You know, I think we probably will talk about that, the differential.
So when we talk about the non-heme or non-blood disorder causes of polycythemia, what are kind of your top three that you typically see?
The top most is this hemoconcentration. So common things are common. And so you want to see if the patient is dehydrated or not. And the second most common would be, is there any hypoxic condition? Be this pulmonary, like COPD, or is this somebody with a cardiac problem with hypoxemia? So I would check if the person is hypoxic or not. You know, that's the most common. There are other situations wherein erythrocytosis, by the way, erythrocytosis is probably a better term. Polycythemia, typically we reserve that for like polycythemia vera, the true hematologic disease. So erythrocytosis, or you could just say elevated hemoglobin. So the dehydration and then hypoxemia, those are probably the way more most common. Of course, for the hypoxemia, COPD, smoking, cardiac conditions, and that you can check with O2 saturation. The next one I would think about would be medication. Or meds, I should say, is the person on, let's say, testosterone replacement therapy, testosterone cream. So that's a common, androgen causes erythrocytosis. Nowadays, I think there has been studies coming from Mayo, in particular, the thing is called SGLT1 inhibitor. I may be botching this acronym, but so these drugs that you use for diabetes and cardiac disorders, you know, that is associated with elevated hemoglobin. And then there are certainly other less common causes in a post renal transplant. I think there's certainly some associations with renal cancer. They can develop cytosis, and some of this is due to increased erythropoietin production. And then, you know, at the bottom of the list, you know, would be some hereditary congenital erythrocytosis, which is really rare. I got to say, in my 20-some years of practice, maybe I've seen one case or two. So this is not something that general practitioners should think about unless the erythrocytosis is lifelong. Typically, this will be in a young person, 20 years old, hemoglobin 18, 19, 20, and then there's a family history. I want to also take note that the erythrocytosis really the concern about erythrocytosis is thrombosis. However, I think we have to take note that thrombosis or getting blood clots is typically doesn't happen unless it's like polycythemia vera. And polycythemia is quite rare. And as a hematologist, you know, I used to practice in the community. And as a pure hematologist, I did not see patients with medical oncology or solid tumors. I may diagnose like 3 polycythemia vera in a whole year in a population served, let's say 200,000 population. So that's how rare is polycythemia vera. And so in general, when the hemoglobin is high, you know, unless this is polycythemia vera, I would not be concerned about thrombosis, even if it's like 19, 20. I think that's always the big question. Should we, let's get the hematology, but this person may clot, but in reality, that really rarely happens.
That's super helpful. Are there, as far as like when you're looking at the CBC, are there other tricks on the CBC or other lab abnormalities that would suggest that maybe this is a secondary elevated hemoglobin, you know, outside of the patient probably coming in short of breath or oxygen or something like that? But is there other things you see?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. So I think I would flip the coin here, because I would say 99% of elevated hemoglobin is not hematologic disease. So the question that probably that I would ask is, are there any signs or symptoms to suggest polycythemia vera? So I think these are some of the things I look at the CBC. The hemoglobin is elevated. Okay, that's a given. The white cell count and the platelets are also elevated, you know, like a pancytosis. That is a potential sign of P vera. If the person has splenomegaly, that's a potential sign of P vera. If the person has what we call aquagenic pruritus, so itching after hot shower, bath, that could be a sign of polycythemia vera. If the patient has, you know, red fingers, hands, you know, what we call erythromelalgia, and it's painful, it's like deep red extremities, you know, discoloration, that may suggest polycythemia vera. I guess that's how I would look at it. If there are any of these signs, then P vera goes up a little bit in the differential diagnosis or pretest probability. Otherwise, it's overwhelmingly not polycythemia vera.
If you see those symptoms, you know, as a primary care provider, is there something else they can do to kind of set up this consultation for you as far as other lab tests or imaging or anything that they need to get before they refer?
Yeah. So we now know that over 99% of patients with polycythemia vera have 2 mutation. You know, in particular, most have this JAK2 V617F mutation. And therefore, one can, you know, if you're highly suspicious now or more suspicious that this is P vera because there's no obvious secondary causes, there's no family history, nothing in the medication that stands out, then one can order, you know, the JAK2 mutation panel. You know, it's a panel because it's V617F mutation and it reflexes to exon 12 mutation. It's an order available in-house. So one can do that. Of course, if that's positive, you send the patient to hematology. And if that's negative, you rule out P vera pretty much. Then you may have to go back and say, hey, did I miss anything secondary? Or maybe this is the time to do an e-consult with hematology.
Is there a number where you would suggest the patient be in the hospital rather than being at a managed outpatient?
No, I would say in general, it's really not the number actually. So let's say we know the person has P vera and the hemoglobin is say 19 or 20 or even 22. I wouldn't admit the patient just because of the hemoglobin is 22. Of course, if the patient has a PE short of breath, I would admit the patient for that reason. Because if I see the patient with a hemoglobin of 22 and I'm sure it's P vera, I'll just go ahead and start hydroxyurea and do phlebotomy. That's the treatment. So I would admit the patient for the signs and symptoms that require admission, even without a diagnosis of P vera. What we're going to do is do phlebotomy for this patient and start hydroxyurea. But in general, it's not really an emergent situation. And so I can think of someone who needs emergent phlebotomy. Somebody comes in with a stroke and hemoglobin is 22. So the patient will have to be admitted anyway for the stroke, regardless of that hemoglobin. In general, asymptomatic high hemoglobin, no matter how high that is, I would just do phlebotomy as an outpatient.
When you talk about phlebotomy, for my education purposes, how much phlebotomy are we talking here? Like how much, what's the goal to draw off?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so certainly I don't do it myself, but we can put an order. Patients go to the infusion center. And I guess it depends on how aggressively you want to do it. But in general, most PVERA patients, hemoglobin 19, 20, not having any acute symptoms in front of you, one can just do a phlebotomy either once a week or once every other week. That should be adequate, yeah. You don't have to do it three times a week, yeah.
Was there anything else, Dr. Goh, on high hemoglobin you wanted to cover? I know most of the time it's going to be on anemia.
Yeah. Now, the one thing about this is, the way we think about this is heme or not heme? And the good news is heme has a test. You do the JAK2, it's not heme, then it's something else. So that's the beauty of thinking that way. Yeah. And now the caveat here is there are rarely normal people with a JAK2 mutation that has very low volume in the blood, what we call variant allele fraction. It's kind of like MGUS monoclonal protein, but there's no cancer. So sometimes that can be anxiety provoking to patients. You know, I got this mutation, but I don't have PVERA. But that will be very unusual.
So that covers high hemoglobin. So I appreciate you walking us through that. Now the tougher one, because such a bigger differential now and a lot more probably hematologic issues, is low hemoglobin. So when you get a call from a primary care provider with a patient with low hemoglobin or anemia, can you walk us through maybe your initial workup there?
Yeah, that's my favorite, you know, anemia. So I think this is how I think about a patient with anemia walking into the door. So hemoglobin obviously is below the normal. And the first thing that comes through my mind, and I tell my patients about this, you know, there's only three reasons or three pathophysiologic processes that can cause anemia. Either you're bleeding or blood loss or not producing or destroying. That's it. Or a combination. If you're unlucky, you get 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 3. Again, I always start with a pretest probability, you know, and if you think about it, it's common sense. You know, number one cause of anemia is blood loss, iron deficiency included in that category. Number two cause of anemia is decreased production. And then number three is hemolysis. Having practiced in the community for over a dozen years in La Crosse, it's very beneficial because I can tell my patient or even tell my trainees here in my practice in the community. So there's no referral. It's all pure, you know, from the community, not a referral practice. I can tell them, you know, say hemolytic anemia, you know, we typically think of autoimmune hemolytic anemia. I can tell the trainee and say, hey, I diagnosed probably 3 to 4 new autoimmune hemolytic anemia in an entire year in a catchment area practice of 200,000 people. So that's like a Rochester. Now that changes in Rochester here because we have a predominantly referral-based practice. So it's very selective. So one thing that I do here, and you know, for the audience who practice here or at the tertiary center, I think about where the patient is coming from. Is it a community within our community, or is this coming from, say, California, New York? The pretest probability of just being blood loss is probably lower because they have been scoped and checked for bleeding. You know, the hemolysis may be a little higher now, or the production is higher. So that's how I think about it. And I formulate my differential diagnosis slightly differently based on pretest probability. So assuming this person is coming from the community, and this applies to referral too. So bleeding is the first thing. And blood loss, we have to consider. And blood loss, in general, it's actually easy to rule in or rule out. And in my mind, you know, I got a simple mind here. You know, it's either you're bleeding big time or small time, all right? Now, if you're bleeding big time, you know, the patient has melena, hemorrhaging, that's obvious. That's the cause of the anemia, unless proven otherwise. All right. Now, the bigger question that I get is, okay, you ask the patient, are you bleeding? Okay, I got nosebleed, maybe 5 minutes max a day, it stops. I got hemorrhoids and so forth, the small bleed, all right? So the small bleed generally should not cause anemia because our body is able to produce a small amount of blood to compensate for that every day. The only time that the small bleed or the drip, drip, drip cause anemia is when you become iron deficient. And so when the patient tells me, you know, I got nosebleed every day, you know, get a ferritin. If there's no iron deficiency, that's irrelevant. The nosebleed has nothing to do with it. Okay. If there's hemorrhoidal bleeding and there's the ferritin is normal, that has nothing to do with the anemia. And if the person doesn't have the big bleed and doesn't have iron deficiency for small bleed, then you move on to the next. It's production. This is where the reticulocyte comes in handy. If the reticulocyte count is low, you know, and I look at the absolute reticulocyte count, if it's under 100 and you're anemic, then you're not compensating enough. If it's above 100, then you're making enough, then it's not a production problem. And so assuming that the reticulocyte count is less than 100, then you think about the various causes of production issues. Nutritional is one. Chronic kidney disease, medications, you know, radiation. We should not forget about in men, you know, anemia from low testosterone, kind of like menopause. There must be a reason why they call it men, you know, menopause. Men also go through menopause. But, and then lastly, you know, always in everybody's mind, is this a heme cancer, a heme disease? That's always the problem. I'll just quickly go through this. So the nutritional anemia, you know, we think about iron, you know, I get the ferritin. The B12 also, you know, for the B12, I generally look at whether the B12 was already performed in the past year or two, because it takes 3 to 5 years for B12 to go away. And so if you have a B12 normal in three months ago, or 6 months ago, or 1 year ago, that just cannot be B12 deficiency. And if there is a B12 deficiency or low B12, it's best to confirm it with methylmalonic acid, because true B12 deficiency actually is less common than we think. I don't check folate anymore unless somebody is malnourished, you know, because we just don't see folate deficiency. And of course, the other thing that I want to add on is the CKD or chronic kidney disease. I generally don't consider anemia of CKD unless the GFR is less than 30. You know, it's common to see stage 3 disease, GFR 45, 49. That should not cause any. If this is a patient in front of you, is a male, a gentleman, and there's a mild anemia, hemoglobin at 12, older, you have to think about low testosterone as part of aging, physiologic. I call it menopause. What I look at is if the hemoglobin, if you change the sex of this person, you know, if this were not a man, he's a woman, for example, you know, because we have different hemoglobin reference range for male and female. If the hemoglobin is 12 and this person is a woman instead of a man, you know, it's a normal hemoglobin. Okay, then that fits with anemia from low testosterone. But if the hemoglobin is 9, that's even low for a woman, then that's not anemia of low testosterone. Usually they're not really symptomatic. And if you rule all of those out and it's still a low reticulocyte situation, hypoproliferative, that's the time when you need to get hematology involved, because really the next thing is, the thing to do is a bone marrow biopsy. I generally don't do seroprotein electrophoresis. I know it may be in the Ask Me Expert, which I don't think should be. I don't get a serum protein electrophoresis, again, because myeloma, it's actually quite rare, 30,000 new cases in a whole year. And that's, I think population-wise, you know, a couple of new cases per 100,000 per year. And Andy, we have 65 hematologists here. So 65 hematologists are going to fight for 5 cases of myeloma here in Rochester. And guess what? How many internists and other practitioners here? Now, so unless the person in front of me has more than 50-50 chance of myeloma, I don't do the SPEP because it doesn't change anything. If the SPEP is negative, I still do a bone marrow because I still don't know what's going on. If the SPEP is positive, I still do a bone marrow. You know, it makes no difference. And most of the myelomas, you know, they don't just present with anemia. They present with anemia, hypercalcemia, at least two of the Krebs signs, renal insufficiency, and so forth. So that's the production. And the last one is hemolysis. So if you get the reticulocyte count, it's elevated, and the person is anemic, and you know the person is not bleeding, then you got to think about hemolysis. It's not a production problem because retic is high, and you have ruled out bleeding based on your clinical history and the ferritin. You know, it's most likely hemolysis. So the first thing I would do is to, obviously, you get a history, and you think of, you do a Coombs test or direct antiglobulin test to see if there's any antibody, because that's easiest to rule out. And if it's Coombs negative, well, I guess before you do the Coombs test, you got to confirm, is this really hemolysis? You get the LDH, the haptoglobin, the bilirubin to support the high retic, and all of those together, yes, it's hemolysis. Then I do the Coombs test, because one can get a false positive Coombs test. It's like an ANA could be positive in a healthy person. And the Coombs test or DAT, direct globulin test, can be positive in healthy individual. It doesn't mean it's an active antibody. Yeah, so assuming you got biochemical evidence of hemolysis, that's when I get a direct antiglobulin or Coombs test. And if that's negative, then you think about the Coombs negative, DAT negative hemolytic anemia, you know, mechanical heart valve, TTP, HUS, which are very, very rare. It's even more rare than myeloma here. It's very uncommon. And then certainly you may see anemia or hemolysis in DIC. Yeah, generally a patient with DIC is not in the clinic anyway, they're in the hospital. So that's how I think about or evaluate anemia. Most of the time I have to admit, just taking a good history, looking at the medications and so forth, more or less you can kind of bucket the anemia immediately, yeah, even before your lab test. You know, you got to look at the historical lab test too. I think some of that may help you. And one thing, and maybe Andy, I should point out here, the other thing that I look at is, you know, many of our patients have prior CVCs. Myelodysplastic syndrome, it's always in everybody's mind, is this a myeloid dysplastic syndrome, leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, unless it's acute leukemia. In general, most of the hematologic malignancies that occupy the bone marrow, whether it's lymphoma, myeloma, MDS, the anemia is like gradual. It's a gradual slide over months, over years, not like this. Acute leukemia, yes, but the person would be pancytopenic, you know, would have no low platelets, would have some other signs, white count sky high, not just pure anemia.
I heard a couple tests that you mentioned, and you left out peripheral smear maybe by accident, or is that kind of something you're not using that much?
No, thank you for pointing that out. I think the blood smear, I order a lot. I have to admit, and this is actually based on some publications too. So in my experience, I mean, I've been doing this for 20 plus years, the blood smear is rarely positive. All right. So it depends on if you're half glass full or half glass empty here. I would say 90 plus percent of the time, it's quote unquote, no diagnostic abnormality, you know, no schistocytes, no spherocytes, no RBC clumping agglutination, no inclusion bodies or something. So I would say 95 plus percent of the time, it's negative. And depending on your pretest probability, if you're thinking about TTP, of course, it's helpful. But if you don't know what's going on, I think for most of the cases, probably less helpful. You know, I guess I wouldn't fault the primary care or the clinician not to do it. But certainly I do it, in part it's because I'm a hematologist. Even if it's negative, I feel happy to see the blood smear.
We didn't talk too much about MCV. I feel like MCV was what helped kind of different or help with the differential. Are you still using MCV to kind of guide workup?
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up, because the MCV can help you narrow down the production bucket. It doesn't help much with the blood loss unless you're iron deficient, but I think I'll talk about iron deficiency in a second. And so the MCV actually adds, it's already there. And I got to say that the MCV is helpful if abnormal. All right. And I'll explain. All right. So I think there's this, maybe it's teaching when I was a med student. There's this teaching that iron deficiency, you know, microcytic anemia, you think about microcytosis. If you have microcytic anemia, you think about iron deficiency. If you have macrocytic anemia, you think about B12, folate. That's true. However, in practice, and this is, you know, adult practice, and we're talking about 40 years old and above, in practice, especially for adults, you know, most iron deficiency anemias are not microcytic. And there are publications about this. And that's because when we get older, you know, except for children, I guess, we have a few other things that can change our MCV. So let's say if you drink one or two glasses of wine every night, that MCV can go up a little bit. And that kind of counters the microcytosis. If you're on certain medications, that will change your MCV. And then we don't really know this, but I think as the population age, the MCV actually goes up a little bit. You know, that's still being studied. And therefore, it's good to see microcytosis, think about iron deficiency. But if it's normal, you still have to think about iron deficiency because blood loss and iron deficiency, remember, it's the most common cause of anemia in adults. So I still get a ferritin if the MCV is normal. Now, same thing with B12 deficiency. Most B12 deficiencies have normal MCV. Now, if you have big MCV, yes, think about B12 deficiency. But if you have normal MCV, I should still rule out iron and B12 deficiency. All right. But if you have macrocytosis, then you can narrow down and say, hey, let's start with B12 rather than ferritin. The one thing also I want to let the audience know is, I think if you look at textbooks, there's this historical differential diagnosis that includes hypothyroidism as a cause of macrocytosis. And I got to say that in general, when I see macrocytosis, I make a distinction between is the macrocytosis associated with anemia or macrocytosis without anemia. And again, this is not scientific. This is just my experience because macrocytosis with anemia, you think of the bad actors, MDS, what they call it, B12, folate deficiencies, and certainly myelosuppressive medications. But if I see macrocytosis without anemia, which is a common consult actually to hematology, I don't think any of those. The ones that I think about is this like regular use of alcohol. Is it medication? Kind of the more benign ones. Used to be, I checked thyroid because that's what I learned from my consultants before when I was a trainee here. But I have never seen a patient with hypothyroidism with macrocytosis. And when I look back at the original publications in the 40s, they were all severe hypothyroid, like myxedema and myxedema coma. And in fact, I have talked to our endocrinologist here, and they said they have never seen really, most of them never seen or have never blamed hypothyroidism for the macrocytosis or have caused anemia, just hypothyroidism causing anemia. So I don't check TSH anymore, personally, you know. So we'll have to do a study just to make sure we have that systematically reviewed. Yeah, but anemia and macrocytosis together, that I do work up. If it's macrocytosis without anemia, I don't really do much. You know, there are certainly medications that can cause macrocytosis, like anti-epileptic drugs. You know, certain HIV drugs may give you macrocytosis without anemia. But those are the things I would think of. I wouldn't think of leukemia, MDS at all. Yeah. They don't need a bone marrow, let me put it that way.
One follow-up on that. When you see the MCV like at extreme, so if you see like an MCV of 120 or an MCV of 50, does that narrow the differential at all, or is there really no correlation in MCV change?
Yeah, I know. I guess when I was growing up here as a trainee, I think, you know, I've read books and consultants telling me if it's above a certain number, you know, it's more B12 or more MDS and so forth. Personally, I don't think that's very useful because if your MCV is, let's say, you know, I'm exaggerating now, 140, for example. Are you not going to get a B12? You still have to do a B12. What if it's 102? Are you not going to get a B12? Assuming there's no recent B12, you're still going to get it. You know, so to me, it makes no difference. My answer is no. Of course, if it's very, very high, you know, the 130, 140, you got to think, you know, the blood smear may help because some patients may have a cold agglutinin, kind of like a pseudo thrombocytopenia, red cell clumping, and that may give false readings, spurious readings. So that maybe, I guess that's the only thing I can think of. Extreme MCV, it may suggest a cold agglutinin antibody. Whether it's a disease or not is another question because you got to find out, is it hemolytic or no hemolysis?
Back on just the microcytic anemias, say we do, the ferritin comes back normal, we do iron studies, everything checks out, it's not iron deficiency, but the patient's still microcytic. Is thalassemia still something that it could be, or is, what else is in the differential there?
I know years ago, we don't really see much thalassemia here or thalassemia trait. Now the population demographic is changing. We see more now. And so I think certainly taking a history is important. You know, the racial ethnic background is important. You know, someone who's from Asia, you got to think about thalassemia, somebody from Mediterranean heritage, you got to think about that. One of the things that I use in the CBC is patients with thalassemia, generally their RBC is above the normal. And that's because their cells are smaller than normal, and it takes more RBC to make the same amount of hemoglobin. So if you got a red cell that is this big with this much hemoglobin compared to somebody with this big, you need 2 RBC to make the same amount of hemoglobin. And so one hint in the CBC is if somebody has anemia or even normal hemoglobin, but the RBC is like above 4 million, above 5 million. The other hint is the gap between the MCV and the hemoglobin. And so I'll just give you an example. If somebody has a hemoglobin of 10 and the MCV is 78, that looks iron deficiency. Now, if somebody has a hemoglobin of 11, or even normal at 12 and the MCV is 65, that gap is big. And this is kind of my own calculation, is I subtract the hemoglobin. So let's say hemoglobin is 10 minus the 100th digit of the MCV. So 10, and then if the MCV is, let's just say 70, so 10 minus 7, the delta or the gap is 3. If the hemoglobin is 12 and the MCV is 65, so 12 minus 7, that's 5. In general, iron deficiency, the gap is about 2. And if it's larger than 2, usually it's 3, 4 or so, then you got to think about thalassemia. Just to clarify this, in someone who has true iron deficiency and the MCV, let's say, is 16, so 6 plus 2, the hemoglobin should be about 8. If somebody is truly iron deficient and the MCV is 70, the hemoglobin should be about 9. But if someone has an MCV of 60 and the hemoglobin is 11, the gap is 5, you got to think about thalassemia. Chances are that it's also very high. That's how I look at it. And this is actually the situation where the blood smear actually helps, because it will show you uniform microcytosis, target cells, and it will show you some signs of thalassemia.
So wrapping up here, you're a hematologist getting referrals from the individuals in the community or an academic center from all over the world. You have a bunch of listeners on the line right now. Is there a couple things you would just want to tell people that would help their referrals to you as far as testing?
So I think just to wrap things up, I think pretest probability is important. And I think my take-home message today is, in general, probably about 60 to 70% of anemia is from blood loss. Maybe 20, 30% is from production. And hemolysis is less than 10% or even less than 5% of the time. One thing I forgot to mention, Andy, is if we see somebody with iron deficiency unexplained, don't forget to ask about blood donation. You know, I've seen many times patients refer to me for iron deficiency unexplained. Patient has been scoped up and down because there is iron deficiency unexplained. You know, I asked the question, are you a blood donor? Yeah, I've been donating blood every 3 months for the last 10 years. That's the bleeding. And if you have that as a reason, then there's really no need to do a scope or GI evaluation. Again, the other thing is if the CBC result or hemoglobin result is unexpected, check it again. If the patient is not sick, maybe wait a week, check it again. That would minimize lab errors and, spurious result.
So we've been talking all things hemoglobin with Dr. Ronald Goh. So thank you for your time, Dr. Goh. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcast, please follow us for weekly content.